I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. John McLaughlin Gray joins me now. The distinguished playwright and author has a new novel out, The White Angel. It's based on the infamous 1924 murder of a Scottish nanny, Janet Smith. Mr. Gray takes us back to 1920s Vancouver, its social mores, class tensions, racism, as well as gives us a sense of the city's establishment, the political and law enforcement institutions, and the press. I've just started it, and it's got such appealing dialogue, I can't wait to finish it. As a playwright, composer, and director, John McLaughlin Gray has created many acclaimed productions, including Billy Bishop Goes to War, which was produced on and off Broadway and won the Governor General's Literary Award for Drama. His previous books include A Gift for the Little Master, The Fiend in Human, White Stone Day, and Not Quite Dead. He is an officer of the Order of Canada. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. JohnMcLaughlinGray.ca is the website for more. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person today, John McLaughlin Gray. Mr. Gray, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, happy.
This is a murder that has interested a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And especially in this town, if you live here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not far from where I live. And
yes, know. Exactly. Well, and it was also the rumor mill at the time created narratives that, because someone is shot in the forehead in the laundry room of a house in Shaughnessy.
Yeah.
Okay? And this is the police, you know, I think a lot more evil is done by willful stupidity than by conscious evil, you know. And the police, they couldn't decide whether it was suicide or whether it was an accident that she was fooling around with the gun. She was doing her laundry. There was it was in the laundry room,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And suicide, it was a World War I pistol. And there were no burn marks around the wound, so she would have had to be a weightlifter to lift, you know, a really full size Webley, you know,
yeah.
and shoot herself. And they kept at that, and that's kind of suspicious, you know.
Yeah.
And you suspect collusion and stuff, and so that caused this rumor mill. To start churning with things like, oh, the Prince of Wales was thought to have killed her at one point. They thought that it was a stag party gone wrong. And they thought there were so many rumors it went around, because that was what Vancouver was then, a real hive.
But Edward VIII wasn't here, was he?
No.
Yeah.
No.
I guess he wasn't called Edward VIII then.
He was
with David, I guess. And
that's right. He was David.
Yeah.
I think. Yes. Yes, he was David.
Yeah. So I guess because it's unresolved, for nearly 100 years, it's fascinated so much of us, so many people, hasn't it?
I guess
it must have begged questions from of you. That you wrote a novel about.
Oh gosh! But and also the environment. It sort of blows open the environment of the time,
yeah.
You know. And there's so much that's going on there that is both really weird and really familiar. You know, I mean, I'm a big fan of holy shit facts.
Yeah.
Things that you just go, oh, geez, I love those. I seek them out. I think my biggest literary influence is Ripley's Believe It or Not, you know?
Yeah.
But the familiar, I mean, you've got a city right then. You've got a city where there's a real estate frenzy. There's an immigration frenzy about Asian immigration. You've got soldiers, veterans walking around with PTSD, unemployed veterans. You know, it's really startling how many things you just go, oh, yes,
yeah.
I can see that. Yeah, yeah.
The more things change, the more things don't change.
Well,
right?
They come back in a different form, but
yeah.
There's not, that's a Vancouver, because Vancouver was built, wasn't a city that was created by like homesteaders or something. It was built, the CPR had it gridded out into lots before the first person came here. So it's a developer city.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And as I said, it's not that far from where we're sitting today. I mean, if we take the 25 bus or
drive
down.
Oh, sure.
That neighborhood still looks the same. All those houses, right?
And those houses were all CPR people. All those names on those streets are CPR executives and all this stuff. Oh, and there's also a thriving drug trade. That's another thing about Vancouver at the time.
Well, what does it say to you when you see these patterns in history and you see where we are today?
Well, I can lock into it then, because if it's not, it takes a different form. And so it kind of enlightens you about how it works now. The rumor mill, for example, and the role of rumor. And I finally got into the idea that the reason for this, and it was wild, the rumors. Rumors were going around about, for example, a lot at such and such that were beside a road or a railway track it's going to be, and it would cause this feeding frenzy. And just like that. And they were, I believe, their sources were switchboard operators.
Mm.
They were called hello girls. And these were young women who were really highly educated, a lot of them, and who expected to go into careers after the war. And suddenly, it all dried up. And they found themselves doing exactly what they were doing before the war, that women were supposed to be on the marriage market, and they were homemakers and switchboard operators and this, you know?
So for people listening to us who don't know what an operator girl is, I mean, if I phoned you now on your cell, for example, I get to
you. You would call your operator.
And they would connect us.
They would connect you, and they can listen into both sides of the conversation.
Yeah.
So I have a switchboard operator who is... who worked in Whitehall, so she was really highly educated. She was a switchboard operator at the Hotel Vancouver.
Yeah.
In Victoria, the politicians were all kept suites in the Hotel Vancouver, because Victoria was, that was not where it was happening.
Yeah.
And so the switchboard operators, I think they would even sell them. I think they were sources for the papers, all that, because they're really bored.
Yeah.
They're way overeducated. And also, they're single. Yeah. You know, after the war, people went around to schools in England and told women that they should, as part of the war effort, accept the fact they're going to be spinsters. Because all the men were either dead or they were wounded mentally or physical in ways that made marriage unlikely. And so that's where the whole feminist movement, the suffragettes, and all that, those things, those all came out of these overeducated young women.
And this ambition. It's coming to a boil, because they can see the I was going to say the glass ceiling, but they can see the limits that that are imposed on them by society.
Yeah.
And so this thing is just going to explode on so many levels. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that must be fun to draw characters out like the switchboard operator at the Hotel Vancouver.
Oh, sure. Once you start usually with either real people or with what you'd think of as forces, you know,
and
the forces turn into real people in your mind. Mildred Wickstrom is a real person for me, as real as anything.
What does she look like?
Oh, she's small, she's clipped, and she's a bit of chameleon, actually. She dresses for every occasion. Right, she comes from a wealthy family, but she also she likes to go into men's places where only men could go, and she would go as a man often to beer parlors and stuff where women weren't allowed, you know. She's also probably the smartest person in the book, you know, easily, you know. But McCurdy, who's a yellow journalist, McCurdy started out being the poet Earl Burney, because he worked when the Janet Smith thing happened. He was working at a paper, right? And so that says, right. But he morphed into nothing like Earl Burney at all, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that, you know?
And so it when you place these characters, I mean, so you take a guy that we obviously know.
Yeah.
and then you place him in the story, and then he obviously doesn't become who he becomes.
No, he just sort of grows into something else.
So when you place him initially,
this character
starts off. He's sort of undercover, right? He's sort of.
I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
I'm in the dark. You know,
yeah.
I don't do outlines first. I mean, when it comes to all the crime novels, I've always been wrong about who did it. I always thought I knew who did it, and I've always been wrong. And this is no exception. It's just, it comes out. And a lot of the characters, they come out of God knows where. You know, ever find out when you're dreaming that you meet people that you could swear you've never met before in your life? Where do they come from?
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes they recur in dreams, and they can they'll show up in certain situations, and you don't know them, you've never met them, and where did they come from? Who knows?
You know? But the writing process for you though isn't like a dream. I mean, it is work. It is. You mean you're physically at a desk or
yeah,
right?
It's a kind of like a lot of it is just lying on the couch thinking. And sort of controlled dreaming. So by the time I sit there at the table, I'm sort of talking about something that actually happened in my mind, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there are. I often. I'm from Nova Scotia, a small town in Nova Scotia that was a dry town. There was no alcohol sold downtown, right?
Yeah.
So the bootlegging industry was flourishing, right? And I used to, because I played with an R&B band, I used to go to the black section of town and spend a lot of time with the bootlegger.
Yeah. It was a segregated place, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's horrible to think about, but it was then. But anyway, to get home, if you're really, really drunk and you're a kid, right, I can remember holding on to telephone poles and steadying myself, then getting a good shove on the telephone pole, staggering to the next telephone pole, and then until I eventually got home, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I do with the book. I have certain incidents that I've got to have that I just know instinctively it's got to be there, so I kind of stagger from one to the other.
And I mentioned in the introduction how delightful some of this dialogue is. Do you spend a lot of time like that, or do these phrases or these sentences are they spoken to you by these characters?
I hear them.
Yeah.
I hear what I write. I don't see it. Okay, even the descriptive stuff.
Yeah.
I'm hearing. I and it has a certain rhythm, and that I have to go. And with the characters, though, frankly, I just write a hell of a lot of dialogue, and then I pare it down. It's writing and editing is the worst thing you can do is try and write and edit at the same time, right? You've got one foot in the gas and one on the brake. And so I basically let it go, and I just write dialogue. It's almost stream of consciousness. And then look through it later and see what's there. Yeah.
When you write plays, I guess the playwright does write dialogue more than anything else, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
so, do you think that's a
very much
hold
so.
Back from there?
Yeah. Oh yeah, sure, absolutely. When a character kind of emerges for you, their way of speaking, it there it is, and that's you'll start later in the book, and they'll be saying something, and yes, of course, they would just say it like that, you know.
How do you get an ear for how people talked in that era of 1924? I mean, there must be a research element in terms of writing this. You go to the newspapers. I mean, do you get a sense of the way that people talked?
Sure. And it was very much part of the class system. You have to first ask yourself what class these people are. And then you want to ask yourself what class do they want to be in, right?
The ambition again, yeah.
And it's easy to find dialogue in books of the time. You know, it's very easy to find stuff like that. There's a book called The Writing on the Wall by Hilda Glynn Jones, and it envisages a Japanese invasion of BC. And it is, you want racism? You want racism in all its glory? Oh, it's really something. Because this was written right then, you know, when the Asian Exclusion League had many, 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 many members. And the Ku Klux Klan were here. Their headquarters was in what's now Canuck House in Shaughnessy.
The Highcroft Manor?
No, Canuckhouse was that big with the big...
Oh, McRae, I think, yeah.
McRae's place is in this book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But the Ku Klux Klan were in that one that has those two round turrets going way up.
The hospice. Yeah.
Yes, that's the one, yeah.
So when you when you're writing this, do you go drive around or walk down these streets?
You walk the book.
Yeah, and so did you get a sense of how it's changed. I mean, physically, I mean, these houses are still there. Like,
yeah.
Places
yeah.
is still there. These houses in
yeah.
where Smith was killed is still there.
Yep.
Do you get a sense of how it's changed, Vancouver?
Oh, not up there.
Yeah.
Not in Shaughnessy. It's still, it's changing. Well, there... Shaughnessy doesn't want anything to change. Everything stays exactly the way it is. But its symbolic position up above the city and over, that's, you know. It's also changed because there's no more. Chinatown, for example, was a discrete town, right? I mean, in the 50s, when the Louis family, who, you know, London drugs, when they moved to Kerrisdale, in the 50s, it caused a tremendous furor. It was really, all these places like Dunbar, Kerrisdale, these were separate little villages.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't come together. And so the police forces were, you know, I mean, people were handed guns before they actually fired one. You know, and the incompetence that's just, it's there to be seen, you know, it's amazing.
So physically, it some of these places haven't changed, but emotionally, mentally, I mean, are those class things still there?
Oh, well, the big thing that's changed is the whole racial thing. Like right now, what we call racism. Oh, well, you know, then the foundation of the nation state was racial, right? That's why the United States is the way it is now, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they want to erase Obama because he was president while being black, you know? And there was a black section of town just off the railway station, right?
Hogan's Alley,
yeah. And around there, yeah, there was the Chinatown. There was the whole Chinese industry. The whole parties ran outright for a white Canada.
Yeah,
you know, keep Canada British was a slogan, and that was code.
Yeah.
You know, the head tax was not paid by the Chinese who came here. It was paid by their employers, and the employers had them then indentured, so they had to pay back, of course, their head tax at hefty. So it was like the Dunsmuirs, all over again, the mines and stuff. You know, when you have chain of restaurants called the White Lunch. This is not the White Spot, but the White Lunch.
Right.
Called so called because people could be assured that their food would be prepared and served by white people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whoa. Just the openness of it is, you know.
This points to the frailty and the danger of nostalgia, doesn't it? Because, I mean, you're seeing people, you know, even when they're talking about current, the way the city's going, they say, oh, well, you know, in the old days it was. But, I mean, the old days were pretty shitty, weren't they?
Oh, it was a hellhole. You know, down in Falls Creek, for example, Falls Creek, where all the condos are, those were tar paper shacks on rafts, where men who had been killed in the or hurt in the logging industry or the fishing industry, and had parts of them missing, plus soldiers.
Mm.
They hung out. That's where they hung out. It polluted when it comes from the logging and the honeycomb burners and the fish plants, you know, and the creosote plants the air was nothing like what it is now. False Creek was a cesspool. We think False Creek, we worry about, you know, people dumping their shit from boats into Falls. Well, yeah. I don't think, you know, we're kind of a first world problem now, in a way, you know, compared to them.
The mayor wants us to be able to surf on it shortly.
Oh, yes, gosh. I know an architect who envisaged making getting a stream coming down and a fountain that would aerate the water in Falls Creek so that the water in the stream would support a salmon run. You know, I mean,
I guess the city doesn't lack for ambition, and I guess this goes to the heart of your book, that people aren't happy with the way they are.
There was very few people here who weren't here because didn't want to be someplace else. Because this was the end of the world, you know. This was the edge of the empire. It was like, boy, other than Australia, you couldn't get more remote. And Australia maybe not so much because it was close to India, which was part of the empire. You know, this was really unlike Britain, that was full of women, this was all men, this place was. But, that was part of the terror about the Asian immigration, because they wouldn't allow their wives in, right? And so it was all Asian men. And the murder happened at a time when Mary Ellen Smith was sponsoring a bill that would say that Chinese men and white women couldn't work under the same roof.
Wasn't she like the first MLA?
Yeah.
First female. Yeah.
Yes. I think that's the best thing you can say about Mary Ellen Smith, but yeah. But you're right. I'm an anti-nostalgic person, basically. I think of those times as in a way dystopias, you know?
Yeah.
You think things are good there? Well, how about this? How about that? You know?
Yeah. So then when you write a book like this and you contemplate the era, you see the patterns of history.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of how our time, how that'll end up or how this story ends?
No, I don't know.
You can't draw any conclusions from...
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. I'm too old to predict the future. I'm just, no kidding. I really am. The past, I can see, you know, how the past kind of, you know, how it kind of
makes
panned
sense.
Out.
Yeah.
Now it makes sense, but no, you're not going to get future predictions from me.
This will be up on the site next week, and you'll have celebrated a birthday.
Yes, 71.
Yeah.
Oh, just, no, the ballroom floor, the ballroom on which I dance and perform my tricks has become about the size of a tool shed now, you know. <It's laughs> But the other thing about it, of course, is that I'm a comic writer. I'm not a writer who writes wagging finger novels or you know, oh, wasn't that awful kind of novels. I take a real perverse delight in this stuff.
Yeah.
Partly because I wrote a lot about the First World War, which was jokes, humor. What else are you going to do?
Yeah,
you know. And it was like that. You can't. You've got to laugh. You know.
When you think of this era, the 1920s, because this is after the war, and that shaped a lot of how people acted, didn't they? Because I mean, you had people here who had just come back and who were maimed and
had PTSD. I mean, they opened a whole wing. They created a whole wing of Essendale, which was the insane asylum, which was for men, and they were vets, and it changed the whole attitude about what caused mental illness. Before that, they thought it was caused by syphilis, mm-hmm. debauchery, and masturbation, right? Mm-hmm. And these guys who had been like Queen's King Scouts went off to war, who were the finest young men of their, and came back way different, you know, plus suicides. I mean, they don't talk. We have no idea how much suicide there was because people covered it up, you know.
Yeah.
But the number of men who were killed cleaning their rifles, which was, it was loaded and with the safety off, who had been using a rifle for like 5 years, you know, in wartime. And the number of men whose cars went over a bank in perfectly drivable conditions, you know, was really, really common. Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, I mentioned Billy Bishop Goes to War and how that war shaped the Canada we have today. So these troops coming back, these men coming back to Vancouver in the 20s, it really does shape the city, doesn't it?
Oh, everyone was in one way or another haunted by the war. I mean, you look at photographs of the Amputees Association. Of men with one arm and one leg or both, you know, it was like the graduating class of a major university. It was like a lot of people, mm-hmm. you know. I have one character who he came. I don't know where he came from, but he's what's called a tin nose man, right? And Sparrow, what happened? What tin nose men were was that. They got shrapnel wounds in the head that blew part of their face out, okay? And because of shrapnel bombs, what a vicious war.
Mm.
Shrapnel bombs were bombs containing really ball bearings, right,
mm-hmm.
that exploded over men's heads and sent this rain of burning flame and just wham, right?
Mm.
And he lost an eye and it would be less than the size of a baseball, but
mm-hmm.
And he had a patch, and what they did was they made these patches very skillfully out of thin metal, so it matched the rest of the face in contour. Then they were sent to ateliers in France, to art places in France, where these people spent weeks painting with brushes with about 3 bristles in them to make them match the rest of the face. Sometimes half a person's face would be gone. So and you couldn't tell until he got closer.
Close, yeah.
And you noticed he didn't blink, you know.
Yeah.
But he also has a head wounds do odd things. They're kind of random, you know. So he has a bad stutter. But he has a sort of second sight. He can sometimes predict something that's going to happen, which is how he met the reporter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reporter soon learned that it was he couldn't control it. Like most psychics, you couldn't, you know, you have to be psychic yourself to know if it's what he's saying is true or not, you know. But that it's one of those odd kind of things that sort of crops up.
And it's fun to think that there are people like that in a city like this, and how many people fall for it.
Oh, gas. Oh, yeah, because people were...
They were looking for something,
right? It was a huge time because of all the men... Because BC sent way way beyond its weight in terms of sending young men to war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whole towns went to war.
Yeah.
You know, Wallachine, the town near Armstrong, that was completely depopulated for men, and none of them came back. It was a town of women because of this. It was really an astounding time that way. And the men who came back, and you also had people who didn't serve, right?
Yeah.
Reporter had bad eyesight, so he couldn't serve, right? But the guilt that you felt. Plus, there was this whole thing about going into to Sears and to various occult things so that they could contact their dead sons and their dead relatives,
mm-hmm.
who it was just a heyday for that sort of stuff.
The institutions of the city, I mean, the press especially, I find fascinating. When you look back at the newspapers and how Yeah. It must be fun to because there were multiple papers.
There were multiple papers, and they
all
were,
from different points of view.
All had different points of view, and they were owned by people who they said what went.
Yeah.
You know, one would be, for example, Victor Odlum, right? Who he was a Liberal MP and ran a Vancouver paper. He was a teetotaler. He was a prohibitionist. And he'd been a general during the war. I mean, that was the other thing, that generals and highly placed people in the war took the same positions, tended to take the same positions in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So you had McRae at Highcroft House. He'd been a general,
yeah.
You know. And they loathed each other. And Odlum was Odlum Brown. That was his company.
And they've got a street named after. They all have streets, I guess.
Oh gosh, yeah.
I can't wait for Chip Wilson Boulevard or whatever.
Chip Wilson Boulevard. Somebody with will have a sense of humor sooner or later.
Yeah, I guess Patterson doesn't need a street because he's got so many buildings named after him.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But I can. It'll happen.
Yeah.
There will be a Patterson Way.
There will.
Yes.
there sure has. When you think of the Vancouver of the 1920s, I mean, this is, a thread throughout your work. The colonial mentality of people in Canada, but especially in Vancouver. I mean, we are oddly, sensitive about where we are and who we are and compared to other...
We're still battling it today.
Yeah.
I mean, because the traditional colonial relationship between the relationship between a colony and the mother country is that the colony exchanges natural resources for culture in the form of finished goods and in the form of whatever, and so, and a whole structure develops in the country around industry. Right, that's based on that. So Canada is as much a part of that colonial relationship, as Britain is. It's not like we're being kind of oppressed.
Mm.
Okay, and so what we have here is that it's based on the notion that we're culturally inferior, right? The mother country in Britain, you know, and that was the genius of the British Empire, really. I mean, building. Send your best and brightest to Balliol College, and you don't have to have troops in the country to keep it British. And especially in British Columbia.
Yeah.
No, I was just, I'm, right now, when they named Prince George, Prince George, boy, what a piece of work he was. And this isn't the guy who came George the Fifth to George, you're right. This is George.
Wait. Yeah.
Yes, this is the George. They had different names when they became king.
Mm-hmm.
George was a drug addict who hung out with a woman, an American woman who was called the girl with the gold with the silver syringe, and he was a drunk and a wastrel, and he swung both ways. He and Noel Coward were caught in Soho at one point, swanning about in women's clothes. They were taken for prostitutes and taken to the police, and then it was sorted out on high. And then what happened whenever that was happening was that the royal reprobate would be sent on a tour of the colonies. You know, off we'd go to visit Australia, to visit, you know,
the Caribbean.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
You know, a lot of people will think of a lot of people become conspiracy theorists.
And
because they think that there's something afoot.
Yes, of course.
And when you read your book and you look at the establishment and sort of the stuff that they get away with.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not hard to believe in some conspiracy theorists.
Well,
theories.
I would put it more as a collusion of interest. I don't think when their interests are the same, I don't think they have to conspire, you know?
And you said earlier that a lot of this was bungled from the beginning, and so it sort of falls into place rather than...
thought conspiracy theories are comforting in the sense that they suggest that something is out under control.
Or organized, yeah.
Yeah, when in fact it's not.
Yeah.
It wasn't under control. But they were, back then, the conspiracy theories were everywhere. They had Germans involved. They had, that the Germans had had abducted the Chinese guy who was eventually charged with the murder. Got off. There's no evidence against him.
Yeah.
It was quite mad. Yeah. Yeah.
So the corruption that you depict in the book amongst these institutions and some of these people, you probably didn't have to invent a lot of that. Did you?
No. It was just people working in their own interests, or what they saw as in their own interests. And
there's a lot going on, right?
Oh yeah. And plus massive incompetence, and incompetence is a real source of corruption because you try and cover your incompetence and all that, and so you kind of talk your way into a. Getting a relationship with somebody powerful, and it just, that's how it goes. So you can easily, just by having the sway of your talk, for example, the guy who does the autopsy into making a different kind of conclusion than might otherwise be made.
I mean, when you take the ambition, the incompetence, and you take the all this stuff together, I mean, I'm surprised that a novel like this hasn't come out earlier.
Well, I sometimes wonder about most people who write. You need a comic sensibility to do it because the contradictions are so.
You can't believe it.
What are you kidding? You know, it doesn't really lend yourself to the kind of serious tension that you usually find in a crime novel. You know, the notion that the sleuth has had a tragedy or a deep, dark secret. There are these tropes that you use that make people take it seriously. And I don't really mean it's black humor. I totally admit that, but it's what I do.
It reveals something about us even today, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And Tom Stoppard said, "Laughter is the sound of comprehension." Right?
Yeah.
That's the wonderful thing about laughter, because it's like throwing up. You can't say you didn't do it. You know.
in this place, I mean, as a setting.
Yeah,
awfully rich and underutilized by writers.
Well, it's also because it was also because of the movie industry, the newsreels, all those new technological developments. Not to mention the phone. It was a kind of microcosm of world events. You know, you could see burgeoning. Fascist. There was a fascist league, for example, here.
Yeah.
You could see all the things that were happening in the world were sort of in embryo here, were stirring around here as well. So it's in the edge of the world, but it's also the world, which is what you look for when you're writing a thriller or a crime novel, is you look for a contained arena that has borders so that you don't find yourself. Well, some people do. John Grisham goes all over the world.
I read on your bio on your website. It says there in 2000 you started writing novels.
Yeah.
Have you stopped writing plays?
Yeah, pretty much.
Why?
Pretty much. Well, what happened was I had a kind of heyday in the 80s, right? But come the 90s, the reviews started getting worse. I don't know why, but I started to get. They say enough good things about you, then they start saying bad things about you, right?
So, yeah.
I also wrote small musicals. Like the biggest musical I did was rock and roll with six characters, you know? And that, this was in the 90s. That was the era when in came the a mega musical with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Phantom and all those, and Les Mis and stuff, followed by The Lion King and these made of movies. And these movies were so expensive, that these shows, that it was like making a movie. It was like doing a screenplay, you know. Yeah. And I've done screenplays, and I know it's a miserable business for a writer. Just miserable. Because all the people with an interest in it, the stakeholders, right,
yeah,
all have something to say about it. They all have something to say. And you have got to, you know, take it seriously and do something. And it'll drive you mad, because if you've got five or six people suggesting and doing things, what they don't realize is that a show or anything you do is a kind of ecology, right? And they're suggesting you eliminate the frogs. Well, what's going to happen with the mosquitoes? If you know, it's like that. It's like whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
And they throw it at you, and you're going to, oh, geez. And it's very hard to keep your temper, and I wasn't exceptionally
and
good
these are
at
corporations
that.
And things like that. Right?
Yes, right? But yeah, that doesn't stop them from having an opinion about what the audience wants to see, you know. Do we like the character? Well, I don't think that's really what... Are we interested in the character? Now we're talking.
Yeah.
Not do we like the character. Are people interested in Hitler? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so.
You don't have to like him to be interested in him.
Absolutely
right?
Yeah. Not.
I find that strain, though, when I read reviews of novels, even. They don't like the novel or the film.
Because they didn't
like the character.
The character
was unlikable.
They couldn't root for the character.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, God. No, it's also that thing about that came up, and it came up in spades, and I thought the musical was going to change because of Stephen Sondheim. And
yeah,
there was these smaller in Broadway that were starting to go in an interesting way, and in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was going to... And, shit, you talk about going back in time. Now we're back to the old musical form, which is that you got a scene that's whole purpose is to set up a song, right? And the whole problem has always been to how you take the scene to the song. And the old American way is you just don't bother linking it at all. Suddenly everyone turns at the audience with a shit-eating grin, and they sing this sort of song whose subtext is, I'm going to be rich, I'm going to be famous, nobody's going to get in my way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As that whole, I'm going to be me, I'm going to get to the top, take the subway to the big time. It's that whole worship of ambition, which I find vastly uninteresting.
Yeah, and so what do you say then to people that think it's, well, that they think it's interesting, or they think that it should be their way of life?
Well, good luck.
I guess you don't hang out with those sort of people, do you?
No. Best of luck to you. On your way now.
I mentioned, I Googled you on YouTube, or looked you up on YouTube, and someone posted this profile that Peter Zosky did of you.
That's right,
He filmed you here, working with your family, and then you went to Seattle on a road trip.
Yes. I was when I was kind of top of the pops.
That's 30 years ago, right?
Time. Yeah. 1986, around there.
Yeah.
And that was when I mean, Billy Bishop for 4 years in the 80s was the most produced show in America. You know? A show about a Canadian war hero in a war that America didn't win. It did lousy on Broadway, but it got great reviews, like in Time and Newsweek, and about 80 different
publishers. And I guess when you're produced by Mike Nichols, that raises your profile in this country. Again, the colonial mentality, right?
Oh, absolutely. As soon as it came out that Nichols was going to, and Lewis Allen, because they just done Annie, right?
Yeah.
Which is another, there we go again, tomorrow. And when it came out, it's kind of pathetic, really. The whole Canadian attitude to Billy Bishop.
You got people talking to you that never, right?
No. And I remember the headline in the Vancouver Sun. It was the headline in one of the Broadway things was Billy Bishop Soars. And in Vancouver, it was Billy Bishop Lands Safely.
So in the piece with Zosky, he asks you if you think you're an interesting person, and you said no. 30 years later, still no?
No, I don't. I don't think I'm. I have good, interesting stories to tell.
Yeah.
And I have interesting things, I guess, sometimes. But I'm now, I think it's worse now, because then I thought my opinions were interesting. And I got it, and I wrote my opinions in the Globe and Mail and the Vancouver Sun and columns. Now, I have no more interest in my own opinions. I don't want to hear from myself ever again about my opinion.
What do you think happens then? Do you find that as you get older, not in terms of older, but I mean as you've lived as much as you have, the more you know, the more questions you have?
The more you see the patterns.
Yeah.
The more you see yourself doing the same thing or kicking the same tack over again. And you really... That's why I like writing novels, or one of the reasons is I like not knowing what the future is. I like not knowing how the novel's going to turn out. I like just being in the dark and being curious and being open to see, just to see what's happening, you know. It's way more interesting for me than trying to kind of churn out. You know, I think that creativity is a vastly overrated word. You're not creating in the way of churning out. You're receiving stuff. You're passing it on. It's much more, it's much like you're an aerial than you're some sort of factory, you know. Mm. And it makes me, when I discover things, it makes me more interesting to myself. I'm interested in seeing where this will turn out. And it gets me through the day. Now, theater, like, I would say 90% of people who go into theater, I think I wanted to become an interesting person. I think a lot of people go into the arts.
I want to tell people I saw the show on the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. You know, theater people and arts people and all over sports. Well, you're very quickly cured of that little illusion. Artists are more interesting than the rest of the world.
See, I grew up, you were writing in the Sun, you were writing the Globe and Mail, you were on the Journal.
Oh, yes, the Journal. That was my most fun geek, period. To do a video, a satirical video a week, I wrote it, and Al Roger and I, we stacked up the tracks, and we delivered the tape, and it was all, there was an element of subterfuge, because we would not be able to do it if the CBC's unions got wind of that I was stacking up tapes, because my fees would get so that it would just be ridiculous. Yeah. If I wanted to have a flute, you'd have to hire me as a flute player.
Yeah.
There was this, we're going to deliver the tape and don't ask us how we made it. And everyone kind of went along with that. In fact, at the end of my, you know, when the big cutbacks came and the freelancers were the first to go, there was a whole memo went through the CBC that this was not to happen again. to have to do it on, I'd write the thing on the weekend. I'd call it in at the end of the weekend, and it would be lawyered Monday morning to see if we were going to be sued. Then Tuesday, I would record it, or I would have written a tune for it and stuff.
Yeah.
Tuesday, Ellen and I would record it. Wednesday, we would shoot it. Thursday, we would mix it. And then Thursday evening, it would go on the satellite to Toronto, and it was on Friday. And so it was one of those situations where if you want to learn how to go for your instincts and stuff, well, you have no choice.
Yeah.
You know, you have to go with your instincts, because you can't think of anything else.
And then the audience that you had for that was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Journal was a big deal back then.
Yeah,
the day,
right? It was my only encounter with street recognition. That was my only encounter. When people would recognize me on the street and stuff, it made me very uneasy.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. People come up and they talk to you about yourself, and I don't find myself very interesting. And
I guess when you're writing, it's a solitary experience.
Totally.
It's unnerving to be.
Yeah. Now editing, I work with an editor. I mean, I worship the editor. To have an expert reader give you what they think of a line by line, and throughout the whole. Boy, is so valuable. You know, the one I did, last one I did for the big guys, Not Quite Dead, I did it for St. Martin's in New York. And I swear to God, I sent them the draft. They ran a spell check and put it between covers, you know? And I'm not such an idiot. I don't know how it could be improved, but I'm not such an idiot as to think it couldn't have.
Yeah. What, when you look at your writing, and then you look at what you've done before, do you think you've improved as a writer with each project?
I think I got a voice of my own more. You always start as a bit of a chameleon, right? Like, I started out, my first, Gift for the Little Master heavy on the Ballard, J.G. Ballard, heavy on William Gibson, though I hadn't read William, but it was that sort of really truncated, fast writing where it was like heavy, heavy voice writing, and it was a voice I put on for the whole narrative, right? With the London novels, I learned Victorian syntax. I learned it by reading Thomas Macaulay. But there's nothing like Thomas Macaulay, Lord Macaulay. His prose, you get from the top to the bottom like that. Mm. With Carlyle, the other historian, you're going over a mighty rocky road, and you're stumbling, and rereading and stuff. And the Victorians, at their best, were amazing writers. I mean, Trollope and Dickens, of course. You know, boy, oh boy. You'd be hard-pressed to find something. But then I started to kind of, my own voice started, another voice, and I don't know, you don't create your own voice, you sort of recognize it. I started seeing, I kind of can see where my taste seems to be going. Like, how do I feel about verbs, and how do I feel about, I go through endless, long conversations with writers about adjectives, and, you know, the thing. You know, how I spent a time period writing. That's another thing I did for Gift, because I was trying to just learn how to. I wrote the entire Gift for the Little Master is written in English prime. Hmm. And English prime is English without the verb to be, right? The idea behind it being that to be falsifies the whole thing, because nothing is. Everything is changing and becoming. Plus, if you eliminate, you don't get passive voice sentences, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was a rainy night. What the hell's it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you don't find yourself in that kind of thing. So I did that. But then I got into Victorian writing, where there is an isness about everything, right? They thought the world was really stable, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it changed my entire, and somehow I sort of, it all kind of congealed into when I, by the time I wrote Not Quite Dead, I felt I had, you know, that was pretty much a voice that I had going, yeah.
How much of the voice that you have now is Truro, and how much of it is Vancouver? You've lived here longer than you lived in Nova Scotia, right?
Sure. Well, there is this, I'm from the part of Nova Scotia, we don't talk like about and like new, you know, we have a kind of drawl where I'm from. It's like, you getting in the car, you know, y'all right? It's that sort of thing. But I'll use that rhythm will show up with anyone who's the least bit kind of rural. I'll start talking like Pictou County and like Truro. And because it's an offshoot of, Scottish accents, and mostly Scottish, actually, you know.
Yeah.
So I will, that does creep in, but I'm not really conscious of it.
Is there a Vancouver voice, do you think? I mean, when you look back at the dialogue from the 20s and to today, I mean, is there something that emerges that's a unique Vancouver quality?
Oh, it was
quality?
So British, Joe. It was, yeah. It was even, when I first got here and I didn't, going to UBC in like 68, oh, Lord, there was the restaurant on next to the Burke's Clock down on Georgian and Granville, Scott's restaurant. It was a dry, there was not, booze was not served, and they would serve cucumber sandwiches with the they'd clipped off
the crusts
yeah. and stuff. The big time shoe store was the British Boot Shop. It was very, very British and also very, very American. There was a whole American thing coming in as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the hippie kind of in business. The whole, you know, down where you had Kool-Aid for freaked out teenagers on acid, run by a Vancouverite named Mike Harcourt.
Yeah.
He ran Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And so it's... I think Vancouver is really defined by these different things coming together, and they do sort of feed one another. But it'll be especially because of the last, you know, since it takes a while, and in the last it'll take another 20 years, you know. But then you're going to start to find. But there is a. It's interesting. There is a Vancouver style of music, of pop music,
mm-hmm.
You know. And all those, that pared down Bryan Adams sort of, that's the headpins, all those. That was a very Vancouver sound. It was white, mm-hmm. but it was really, it borrowed from black stuff, but it was... There's enough, a lot distinctive about Vancouver, but there's no Vancouver accent.
No.
There are several. Yeah. The Carisdale matron's accent.
Yeah, yeah. That's about it.
Yes, there's what do they call it? The way girls, they kind of growl.
Oh, vocal fry.
You vocal fry. Yeah.
That's Yale Town.
That's Yale Town. Yeah, yeah.
What you're about to be 71.
Yes.
Your grandmother was you know.
109.
And your 109. Parents.
109. Oh, my mother was 76 when she died. She had a heart thing, but there's also some there is some dementia. Running through that side of the family, and I looked at her crossword puzzles, and she was slipping a bit, and she also had a heart thing, and I should think she had a heart event, and she was by the ocean, and she just sort of kept going, and she was found floating off the coast of Pictou Harbor, and my dad went at 79. He lasted the 3 years. Maximum that usually couples.
That's what they say, yeah.
That have been together. Well, he was right in the button. He lasted the 3 years and stuff.
So they say these things skip generations. So
well, it's a recessive gene, so you just don't know.
You can't
know. It's like music. I mean, I have like absolute pitch things, and that's a recessive gene.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of shows up. Now, my grandmother... She said she got real sick of it. She got sick of going to funerals.
Mm.
She lived in a village that of about 150 people near Stellarton in New Glasgow in Pictou County, where my family has seven generations lined up in the graveyard, you know.
Mm.
And she went through all her brothers and sisters, all her... She outlived all her children except for my dad. She outlived the whole village, died. She moved to Stellarton. She outlived everyone that she knew in Stellarton.
Yeah.
Then came, moved to Truro, and was working on... She had outlived everyone and was working on a new generation and having to go to these funerals again. And she just didn't like it. She was said it's just too many funerals. Yeah.
So when you think about it, you've got what? 20, 30 years ahead of you?
I don't predict the future.
No. Do you live one day at a time then?
Yeah, basically.
Do you?
Basically. Yeah. I don't have any real plans. I'm starting another novel.
Yeah.
You know? And I can't because it's set in Vancouver again, and it's the next year, 1925, right? And it's with the Liquor Commission.
Mm.
You know? It's about to...
I mean, there's so many things that one can think of in terms of just booze, of writing about booze, right?
Oh, when you consider that the Liquor Commission consisted of like three people, right, and the Attorney General, and they had... they had their own secret police. They had the dry squad, who were empowered to break into people's houses without a warrant, who could charge people if they were in possession, or if they were drunk, they could charge them in their own house, where they went to a court where they were guilty till proven innocent, there where they had a big budget to fund to fund informers. I mean, doesn't it sound an awful lot like East Germany? You know? That, and where liquor was responsible for 15% of government income, of total government income.
Yeah.
It was, and yet only half the liquor was being sold by the government because it was adulterated. It had been marked up and through all kinds of corruption stuff. It cost, by the time it got in the liquor store, $12 for a bottle of scotch, when the average working salary was 25. It had, you know, it was, so the bootlegging industry was huge, and it was quite decent. You know, it was just locals. Yeah. The money was staying in town, and the booze was better, and it was cheaper. So there was this war on bootlegging, right? And you can see how could this pan out into a kind of police state situation. I kind of love that idea.
So how are you writing it? Are there a lot of time on the sofa?
Lots of time on the sofa.
Yeah.
Staring it out the window. It's also not thinking about it. You know, it's often, you know, as we know, because of dreaming, your mind is doing stuff. You kind of want to get past the part of your mind that thinks it's thinking.
See, I'm sleep deprived. I don't get enough sleep. I'm four or five hours max.
Oh, that's not enough.
And so I don't have time to dream.
Oh, you dream.
Do you?
You have to have some.
But I can't remember.
To have some REM sleep.
You know?
Well, you could probably remember bits of your last dream. And if you wrote down little details of it, you would find more and more would come to you at that last. And you would find yourself remembering more and more, right?
Yeah.
And you'd probably sleep longer.
Yeah.
Right, because it becomes another world. It becomes sort of, you're not just shagging out. It's another world you're visiting, another universe.
See, I love naps. I mean, I.
Oh, well, you see, that's what you're doing. Yeah.
Doing that during the day, and then I can.
Yeah, sure. Lots of.
Knock off at night. Yeah.
A lot of Thomas Edison and all these people. Thomas Edison could nap anywhere. He would curl up on his desk and nap for a while.
Yeah. And so when you're doing that, and then you get to writing. Is it at a desk? Is it on a computer?
I'm sitting down with a laptop.
Yeah.
My legs crossed and sitting on some place. You know, I have this office that's about the size of the palm of your hand. That only one other person can sit in there comfortably, which I like.
Yeah, that's probably good for
writing. I think three really is a crowd.
Yeah.
And I like it in there, you know. Yeah. I'll sit there and I do an awful lot of research as I go along, you know. Sometimes I think I find myself researching every frickin' noun in a page just to find, well, would they have said that? Or was that, what did they call that? Or what kind of cigarettes did that particular person smoke? Because everyone had their brand, and each brand had a different, whether it was the one they smoked in the war or whether it was cheap, rotten cigarettes, black cats were really looked down on, whether there were, you know, that sort of thing. And you'll find yourself going there. And, of course, in going that, you're going to go sideways and go, oh my goodness, holy shit. And you find yourself off away you go, right? And an hour or two have gone, and all you've done is have researched like a noun.
But it's fun still, writing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fun, and it's even more fun when you know instinctively, no matter how what a mess it is, that you, there is a beginning and a middle and an end. And then you can lie down and you can close your eyes and you can dream your way through it, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a movie. Because it takes about 6 hours to read a book, you know? And it's like a six-hour movie that you can put down. It's in chapters. And you can, you know, it's kind of in bite sizes and stuff. But it is a sort of a movie. It's a controlled dream, you know, except it's in here, not out there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how else do you occupy your time? What do you do for leisure?
I got a new bike.
Do you? Yeah.
Oh, I got a Ridley. A friend of mine sold it to me. It's so freaking light. You can lift it with your tongue.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah.
And I'm scared. Oh, I've laid down on it several times because it's like a whole new experience because you're attached to it.
Yeah.
And it's twitchy. It's not as stable, obviously, because, you know, it's like the Sopwith Camel. It killed more soldiers in training or airmen in training than any other plane because it was in the first 6 feet was the weight so it was unstable. Plus the rotary engine, it was faster to turn to go left, go around, go right and around than it was to turn left. And if you could, if you were a good pilot and were good with it, you could use that instability to reverse positions with a plane or do all kinds of maneuvers that people were able to do. And that's kind of what I like with the bike. I do it, yes. And I try to, I'm engaging myself with crossword puzzles. When I can, the New York Times crossword puzzle is one of my measuring sticks, right? I can do the Friday pretty good.
Yeah.
The Saturday, it's getting iffy.
Yeah.
When I can't bath off the Tuesday crossword prayers, then I'll know we're in trouble.
Mm.
And then we'll start having to make decisions. Yeah. Yeah.
But do you go to the theater much?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I have ADD. I was brought up in school. I had all the markers. My son Ezra had the markers too, and we went in, and the guy said, "Yeah, you got a level of ADD, and my boredom threshold is really low, really low." School was just a nightmare, a nightmare. I was an underachiever, and they just beat you with it.
Mm.
You know, in primary school, they test your hearing to find out if you're deaf. Right.
Mm.
And boredom, whether you're bored doesn't enter their minds, you know. And it's it's directing plays and in the theater, working in the theater.
Yeah.
It's a dandy way. It's not a deficiency at all. I get bored before anybody else,
yeah.
You know. But theater, I go, and sometimes it really works for me. But often I nearly die. I can't feel my feet. I can't feel my hands. I want to lie down on the floor and curl up people's feet and just listen with my eyes closed. It's terrible.
Yeah.
That's something I bear all the time is this, you know. And I do things that ADD people do. I interrupt people and and all this stuff. Ezra, you know, I would go in to talk to teachers, and I would say, okay, he's occasionally disruptive. He will not stop reading something that he's doing something he's interested in and switch tasks. He will not do something if he's not interested, will not do that. And I would go down the list, and I said, do you have anything to add? And they said, not really. And that would be it.
Mm.
Because they had no... One principal, this was in primary school.
Yeah.
I said, maybe he's bored. And the principal said, oh, he can't be bored. This is a really interesting program. And you talk about the urge to do the horizontal lunge straight for the throat, you know. Whoa. Gosh.
When you're writing, you're able to harness these things because you enjoy writing, right?
Yeah. Well, if I'm interested in a part, you can't pull me away. That's the two sides of ADD.
And why don't people realize that and sort of figure out jobs or how to educate people, you know, in a way that works for them? Rather
their style of learning.
Yeah.
Good question. What a good question.
I guess that's
the answer is that it doesn't fit the factory system of education, where you have a bunch of people sitting together who learn as a group, and so that it's deficient. It's a deficiency because it's in the classroom. It really holds up the classroom. And that it's not good for the smooth running of a classroom to have somebody with ADD sitting there. Yeah. They're either not, and oh Lord, well you're probably better at it. But my God, that experience of sitting there and you're in math class you start, and he starts it, and you're with it, and he goes, and then your mind can't stay with it, and your mind goes someplace, and it comes back. And he's talking with something, and he might as well be talking in Swahili.
Yeah.
And you can't put your hand up and say, could you go back to the beginning, please? <It's laughs> So you get up, they say you're lazy or you're not paying attention. Now, isn't that a loaded word, to pay attention? Yeah. You owe attention, and you have an attention deficit. Like, you know, like you're running a deficit.
Yeah, you've calculated it already.
Yes, exactly.
I so much appreciate you coming in to do this. When they said, would you like to talk to John Gray? I said, absolutely. Would he mind coming over? Because I'd like to meet him.
Oh, yeah.
I've watched you. I remember you used to be on that panel with Gabbro all the time.
Oh, yes.
On TV. And,
oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so for you to come in and talk about this book, which I'm enjoying a great deal. I mean, it's just fun for me. You'll never understand what this last hour or so has meant for me.
Oh, look, I really enjoyed talking to you. We talked about stuff that I haven't heard the same question 15,000 times.
Are you getting a lot of that?
What gave you the idea to write this book? Well, I was walking down the beach and I looked up. There it was.
You've been interviewed. Well, I mentioned Zosky. You've been interviewed by everybody
in my life. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can only imagine when you're interviewed by a lot of people, especially for when a book like this comes out, the sort of questions that you get, and how do you not go nuts?
you do work out a way of answering really, really quick. Really, really predictable questions, so that your mouth's just moving, your mind's someplace else. Your mouth is flapping away, and words are coming out.
But again, I wish you many congratulations for this book. I know the notices are coming out now; they're quite good for it.
Yeah, that's
and,
great.
And
also, there are good notices that depress you as bad as bad notices. You know, when they don't get it, but they get it.
Yeah,
you know, and that's really. That's nice. That's a good thing. Yeah.
Well, thanks for doing this. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Joe.
The book is called The White Angel. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author John McLaughlin Gray. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.